Our guest now left a senior job at the World Bank in Washington, D.C. to return home to Aotearoa, New Zealand, where she's turned her energies to our housing crisis and the part off-site construction can play. Jane Henley grew up in New Zealand, was the founding chief executive of the Green Building Council. She went on to lead the Global Green Building Council before joining the World Bank as Global Operations Manager of Green Building for the bank's private sector arm, the International Finance Corporation. Along the way, she got a Master's in Business from MIT. But like many Kiwis abroad, the COVID pandemic awakened the urge to come home, which she did with her young daughter last year. Jane Henley now consults Te Kāinga Ora, the government housing agency, on its strategy, particularly in the area of off-site construction or prefab housing. She says it's absolutely the way forward for New Zealand to solve its housing crisis in a sustainable, innovative way. And by the way, she says this does not mean us all living in identical shoeboxes. Jane Henley's with us now. Kia ora, Jane. Nice to talk.
Kia ora. Good morning.
Quite a career there that I'd love to go back over, but let's begin with the whole issue of off-site construction. One of the matters I've had raised from within the industry, including those trying to get this going here, is that you need critical mass in order to build the factories, get all the infrastructure, you need enough business. Is that possible here?
Yep, that's a fair call that I think many people have made. We do have a small sector, and I think that's our biggest challenge, is our scale and our size. And I think really what's needed and what we've been working on this last year is to figure out how government can really spark this sort of shift in thinking in a very thought out, sustainable way, and not just sort of thinking that this is a silver bullet, but essentially the agenda is around driving productivity and slowly transforming the way that we work in the construction sector, because the construction sector is one of the last sectors to innovate, to have any change in it. It's extremely hard to drive any innovation or change across such a segmented, complex value chain. So it's fair. That's why government thinks in the unique kind of New Zealand situation, it can play a key role in driving that demand from its larger, checkbook. The way that it orders and procures, then it can actually drive that type of demand that these type of factories actually need to set up.
This isn't about government regulation or government subsidies. Not at all. This is about government being the biggest customer initially.
Yep. So government, Kāinga Ora itself is about 7% of the residential market. So it's the biggest, it's the biggest single source of demand. And so what we see is that if we play a lead role in all of the pieces of the puzzle that need to come together to enable off-site manufacturing or prefab to scale, then that's a very important thing that we can do purely with our choices, not with any policy. And so there are other government departments that come in behind with the policy.
There are other government agencies as well, I think. Defence has a lot of property. I'm not sure if it's developing new property, but there are potentially others as well with infrastructure projects where this could happen. How would it work then? Because their procurement systems are interesting in government. And again, if you were trying to get the private sector to invest in factories and invest in infrastructure and invest in staff for prefabs, would that mean they would need a lot of government business?
Look, there's a real fine line, because obviously government has procurement rules, right? And so and government doesn't want to put any business at risk by just taking by just serving government. So there has to be a real mix of industry and government. And the kind of minimum order one of these factories needs is about 50 units at a time, and they really want that type of order over a 3-year period, so they can have that sort of baseline moving forward and really be able to set up, as you said, staff and supplies. And then in addition to that, they can take market orders and have a little, take small orders, might be 10 at a time or, 20 at a time from, larger developers. But that's essentially the smallest, and then it needs to grow from that.
Okay, let's look at those 50 units, and let's do this in a little bit more detail. For those of us who went through the horrors of prefab classrooms for a time far too long ago, what do current off-site construction or prefabricated buildings look like? What are they made of? How are they made? How quickly? What does it look like now?
So you wouldn't be able to tell the difference for a start. From the outside, from an end user's perspective, all you're going to get is a better quality, more airtight, and potentially a more sustainable building if they include Homestar. So all of the Kāinga, everything that comes out of Kāinga these days is certified Homestar. So everything's going to be of generally a higher standard than what the, you know, sort of lowest common denominator is in the industry. Apart from that, you won't know. It'll be delivered on site faster, anywhere between sort of 40 and 10% faster. At this stage of the maturity of the market, it won't be any cheaper. But as we start to see scale, we hope to see those efficiencies in cost, but we won't see that for a few years. And then if you just imagine, like, I live in Auckland, right? There's a lot of big developments going on in very dense urban environments. That building's going to go up quickly. There's going to be less traffic, less trucks coming in and out, less, you know, subcontractors and vans coming in and out the buildings there, and then it's occupied as normal. So less kind of urban disturbance in there as well.
Where are the countries that are the models for this?
This Sweden's probably the pin-up child. They started doing this a long time ago, and they had a project that was driven by government to do 1 million homes off-site. And they now have, the market is completely non-government, you know, it doesn't have any government intervention, and about 80% of houses below about three stories are manufactured off-site. Can essentially order it off a website and choose your facade, choose your colour, you know, there's some flexibility in design so that we don't have that cookie cutter approach, like, you know, like what some people think in their minds. So really it's no different to what you'd be ordering off any kind of developer that's building traditionally as well.
Is the structure of the construction industry different? Clearly it is if it's highly prefabbed, because the complexity of our construction industry, and you alluded to it, appears to be part of the problem. You know, when do the plumbers turn up, and when do the other subcontractors turn up, and when do the concreters turn up, and when do the prefab people turn up? The coordination is often between a whole set of different contractors and even companies, right? And that can have financial risks, and it can certainly have coordination risks, especially at a time when we've got supply chain challenges. That's beggaring up any number of builds at the moment. Could you comment on the structure of our industry, and will that, can we do this within the way things are operating now?
I think getting to the point that Sweden's at now is will take a long time. I think one of the differences in where, say, Sweden is at, and, you know, there's some countries in between, like Scotland and England and Australia, that are sort of on the journey but not quite as far along as Sweden. Essentially, the main difference is that the companies are larger over there, and they can invest more capital in technology up front, and they have a bit more certainty in being able to have enough coming through their factory. So here we're going to have smaller factories. We're going to have to be very careful about not, those factories are going to have to be careful about not over-investing in technology. So I see it essentially being a slow transition to kind of a low to mid-tech type approach, that we can manage the smaller demands as the industry starts to change, and as that, you know, complex supply chain is happier working, you know, in a factory environment rather than in the elements of on a building site. And so that will take time because there's a mindset shift, right?
Mindset shift, but also getting momentum. As we said, there are builders, so there are building companies who have been trying to do this here, and these are the ones I've heard from saying we need critical mass in order to invest. The truly interesting thing in Sweden is they had this 1 million homes project and they ended up flooding the market, didn't they? It ended up overbuilding.
They did.
Which would seem like a happy problem here at the moment, but perhaps not to people who are overstretched on their mortgages at the moment, right? It's a complex equation. You've brought together a cross-government collaboration. Can you talk more about what you're doing there? As we said, this seems such a complex area. And again, lots of government agencies with fingers in the pie as well. What are you doing with them?
Yeah, it's all about collaboration, and that's what's so hard. You know, we're not necessarily set up for this type of collaboration, and I guess it's one of the reasons why I'm involved and love this sort of thing. But yeah, it's as we talked about before, the size of the order for these factories needs to be large, and so we've brought together. You mentioned defence, Ministry of Education, MB, who do the policy side of it, and hopefully that'll expand out to also skills with MSD. And potentially out to community housing organisations and other large demand creators to come together to go, what do we need to standardise? What do we need to define to enable sort of an interoperability along that supply chain so there's not, you know, millions of designs needed for, you know, the same type of bathroom and to really get some efficiencies in the actual process of how we build a house that's transferable between businesses. And so if government sets a bit of the structure and the framework of that, you know, within this collaborative environment together and then partners with industry so that this is done kind of, you know, as a collaboration between industry and government, then I think we can move this agenda forward. We haven't had this approach yet. It's been one-off companies that have invested and potentially over-invested. But this is a new way to approach it. This is collaborative. This is taking a very strategic, long-term approach to this whole system transformation agenda.
What else is the problem, as you see it, in our housing and accommodation market? The price of land, the value of land, is one part of it. Okay, the build on top is a whole separate issue. Things like the urban sprawl and then the need to be providing services. And again, councils go, hey, we can't be putting in all the new services for whole new suburbs and whole new developments opening up. We don't have the rating base for that. When you look at our overall situation, what else do you see as solvable parts of our housing crisis?
Yeah, well, we start starting to get into kind of macroeconomic policy and that, you know, it gets a bit complicated. Like if you just compare to Sweden, for example, they don't have the kind of investment in the real estate agent sector by mum pop investors, right, like we do. They have people that invest their savings into the share market, and the companies that do these factories are actually listed companies. And so we have this really different sort of industry structure in New Zealand that's going to be quite hard to shift.
Do they have build-to-rent, big build-to-rent companies? If you want to invest in property, yep. You invest in those, right? Is that what happens?
Yep. Yep. Okay. And yep, other sort of, you know, REITs and just other sorts of real estate vehicles or companies in general, you know, Volvo or whatever company type structure that you like. But so, yeah, it's the way that we rely on our real estate sector for our retirement is a big challenge. And that's really driving a lot of the prices up, and it's going to be a hard shift. So I think what this agenda is about, it's not trying to solve all of the issues. It's trying to say, within industry, we're going to take ownership for productivity, innovation. We're going to work together, and we're going to solve some of these problems. And we know that then it's not going to be everything, right?
What's happening then with Kāinga Ora and specifically its approach to this?
Yeah, so just last week, actually, we published the strategy, which can be, if you just search OSM on the Kāinga website, it's called Transforming Construction Through Innovation. So we've really laid out, they've laid out the vision and what's possible and how the different parts of that business have set targets to procure more offsite manufacturing and also to, you know, be a leader. And so this government collaboration that we're talking about is being led by Kāinga Ora, because we see that Kāinga Ora can't do this alone. Nobody can do this alone. And so it's that leadership role that they're playing in bringing everyone together, which is vitally important. We can't just rely on industry to do this one.
There are some other significant players in the private sector as well. You mentioned the so-called mums and dads, and they provide a significantly high proportion, whether they've got one or two properties or whether they've got, you know, 20 or 25, they provide a very significant proportion of the private rental market. We are seeing a nascent build-to-rent investment model developing, where you invest in the company itself, not directly in the house. But another big opportunity I would have thought was the retirement villages and complexes, because with our aging demographics, you know, they're building pretty flat out. Can that work for them? It's obviously a different kind of layout, potentially, but can prefab work with their developments?
Completely. Yeah, that's another one of those big demand creators. They're tending to build more than 50 units at a time, right? So it's a huge opportunity for them. And I know that some of them are already looking at this. You know, there's a couple of new factories, or one for sure that I know of that's starting in Auckland at the moment. So yeah, that's one of the early adopter markets for this, just because of the size of those orders, like you mentioned. You know, they're building a lot and it's growing.
How many factories do we have now then producing prefab buildings?
So, you know, there's a real range. So I'd say there's about six sort of higher tech factories in the country now. And then there's lots of smaller, more like building in a shed type setup, to keep it simple. It's not quite that simple, and they will adopt technology over time. They'll grow their space over time, and they will become a larger, a sort of mid-tech factory over time. But essentially, the smaller players, the SMEs that are doing, you know, under 50 units a year, or definitely under 100 units a year, those are the ones that there are lots of, 20, 30, 40, depends how you want to count them, all doing slightly different styles and solutions of what we would define as off-site manufacturing. And if anyone's interested, you know, all of those definitions are in that document on the KO website as well.
I don't know if you can help with this.
It's not just one type.
Sure. I don't know if you can help with this question. It's just come in from a listener. Can you comment on whether banks won't lend on the private purchase of pre-built homes? I'm wondering if this is where the homes are entirely constructed off-site. Is that a different market?
It's just when the mortgage is generally associated with the land, and so they struggle to provide the money for the mortgage when it's in the factory, because it doesn't have that, it doesn't have the same coverage for them to sort of claim back if there's a default. But the banks are looking at this. We've been talking to a couple of the banks to look at how they can either have some type of insurance or just change the way they view that risk. It is currently a bit of a barrier, but it's, you know, it's about to be solved. I don't see it as a major hurdle.
So does that affect prefabs that are constructed on site, where things are trucked to the site, or does that affect these entirely pre-built homes that you then move to land?
It can affect both. So it's the bank's risk profile on what they're paying for and where it is, and whether it's, you know, whether it's associated with the land or not, and how they view that. So basically anything that's built primarily off-site does have a few challenges on if it's funded through a bank.
Goodness, so many moving parts. Jane Henley is our guest. She is back in New Zealand. She was the founding chief executive of the Green Building Council, went on to lead the Global Green Building Council, joined the World Bank as global operations manager of green building for the bank's private sector arm, the International Finance Corporation, now back in New Zealand and consulting primarily to Kāinga Ora. Just after 25 minutes past 10, it is on 9 to noon. Let's look at what you achieved while you were away. Many years abroad, the last three in Washington, D.C. with the World Bank, managing a $21 million portfolio of projects in seven developing countries. It's funny, isn't it? We talk about the complexities of the New Zealand environment. I don't know how it compares. What were you doing in that work?
Yeah, we were. So development banks, you know, they either go in alongside investment into a government or private sector investment, and to look at how they support the market with this change that's happening. So we were either working on building codes, or we were supporting green bonds, so that the market knew how to actually deliver a more usually just sort of low sort of target energy efficiency, not as ambitious and as holistic as Homestar here in New Zealand. It was a real range of how do you basically improve the building sector around energy efficiency, usually attached to carbon, you know, to some carbon commitment or an NDA. So it's sort of coming from the overarching government pressures to need to do something around energy efficiency and to meet their carbon targets, you know, a real range of things.
You were involved at COP26 recently in discussions on sustainability and construction. That's an interesting space. What are your reflections on the climate summit in general, and then you might speak more to how construction's doing?
Yeah, so I mean, it's the type of thing that, you know, someone will probably want to turn the radio off when we start talking about COP, right? COP26. It's not that interesting, but it creates an overarching structure to enable us to do something about these intangibles, and this happens to be carbon. Like when you get your water bill, you know what you're paying for the water you receive, and you know what you pay for your wastewater. So essentially, we're trying to put the same structure around a pollutant called carbon, right? So we're trying to put a price on that wastewater price, and so that the people who use it pay for it. And so it's a little bit tricky how that's structured, because the people who pay, that's where the scrapping and the, you know, arguments come. And then there's also issues around the developing countries versus the developed countries. So it's COP26 was pretty typical that we delayed any major commitments. And but for the building sector, it was actually quite interesting, because there were about 80 countries that had a commitment to do something around building efficiency. And then in this COP, 50 more made some commitment around building energy efficiency. So that means that development banks and one of the not-for-profits that I'm the chair of that are focused on this policy side of things have 50 more countries this year that want to understand how at a structural industry government level they actually move towards more energy efficient buildings, whether it's through offsite manufacturing or just pure building code policies. You know, there'll be a range of solutions to get there. So, and you know, in some ways I'd say a good outcome for the building industry.
Co-founding the Green Building Council and then going on to the international job, what is it that started this whole career pathway for you?
Oh, I guess I'm just one of those people that just keeps searching, you know. I'm just one. I feel like we can always do better, and then I just get one opportunity after the next, and you know, the search for the holy grail. And yeah, then eventually, I guess I've just kind of realised that everywhere has the same problems, everywhere has a similar structure, and you know, after many years of working internationally, I realised I was a bit ungrounded. And I really wanted to kind of have some roots into the land and into where I live. And so I decided to come home. So maybe I found the Holy Grail. I'm not sure. I'm still trying to interpret that back into the New Zealand context.
Well, there's plenty of challenges for you here in the area in which you work. So the search may continue. But does it feel good to be home? Because it can be discombobulating coming home after a long time away. Does it feel absolutely right?
It feels very right. I think, you know, one of the challenges about coming home is you have these expectations about that. Whereas when you go away, it's just all new and it's exciting. Whereas when you come home, you're kind of going into a movie that's been playing and you're coming back in as a slightly different character. And so you have to redefine yourself and where you fit into that movie that was running. So it's taken a couple of years now, and I feel like, you know, we're all grounded back here and very, very happy to be here at this particular time in, you know, what's happening in the world. And just so grateful to be connected into what's happening in New Zealand. It's an exciting time here.
Kia ora, thank you, and keep in touch. Jane Henley, who is now consulting to Kāinga Ora. It is 29 minutes to 11. We have some headlines, please, with Katrina.
Fire crews, helicopters and bulldozers are today strengthening containment lines around the Kaimomo fire in the far north. Peat fires are burning underground in the wetland. Early studies from the UK and South Africa appear to show the Omicron COVID variant to be milder, but there are still concerns the sheer number of cases could still overwhelm hospitals. And the Department of Conservation says swimmers in the Bay of Plenty don't need to be more concerned than usual about sharks, despite more sightings in the area where a teenager was killed in January. It says overall the great white population is stable, and shark attacks are rare. It's 29 minutes to 11. More news and weather at 11.
What if science fiction wasn't as far from the truth as we thought?
Then it's terrifying. It's going to be bouncing around the universe, taking all the energy.
RNZ's new podcast, Sci-Fi Sci-Fact, takes the strangest ideas and explores whether they could actually happen in real life.
But if you start squeezing lithium down, it becomes actually a dilithium solid.
Sci-Fi Sci-Fact is available on the RNZ website or wherever you find your podcasts.
28 minutes to 11 it is on 9 to Noon. Well, Hugo Jai introduced us to what he suspected might be another number one hit for Lad Baby earlier. This husband and wife couple, they're not particularly, you know, musical or musically noted. We were pointing out, you know, normally it's George Michael or it's Mariah Carey or it's Cliff Richard who gets rolled out and makes number one at this time of year. But with the demise of the record industry as such, Lad Baby's been racing through the last few years with classics like I Love Sausage Rolls. They've gone up a league clearly because Elton John and Ed Sheeran feature in what you're going to enjoy next. This is Lad Baby with Sausage Rolls for Everyone.
Build a fire and gather round the tree.
Come and sing and dance to Sausage Rolls with me. Here we go. We are back, trying to make history for charity. And may I introduce to you Ed Sheeran and Sir Elton John. No pressure. Let's have a party, it's Christmas Day. Your mum's cooking turkey but been moaning since yesterday.
The presents are open and the bin bags are put away
just until Boxing Day.
Let's dance, Merry Christmas.
Get to the kitchen for sausage rolls.
This is Pure Family Goals.
Let's sing Merry Christmas.
The sausage rolls are on.
Yes, ma'am.
And I'm gonna be a bad joint as one.
We're having so much fun.
While we're here, can we all spare a thought for the kids who have none?
Sausage rolls for everyone.
Christmas was here to stay. The last one was love.